Every day, in a variety of ways, people share their personal information with others. Now, in most cases, this sharing is perfectly legal, and the ultimate goal here is convenience, bringing convenience to people's daily lives. However, our guest this morning, James Rule, argues that this personal data that we make available to countless organizations can also surface elsewhere and be applied to very different purposes, at least not what we would intend. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about privacy and surveillance. And our guest is James Rule. He is distinguished affiliated scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at the University of California at Berkeley. And we'll be talking about what you can find in his book, Privacy in Peril. The subtitle is How We're Sacrificing a Fundamental Right in Exchange for Security and Convenience. The book is published by the Oxford University Press and deals with themes that he has been dealing with in his academic work for a long time now. He makes the argument in this book that perfectly legal uses of our personal data by both government and private industry are more widespread and perhaps more dangerous than we had ever suspected. In addition to his present position, our guest, James Rule, is former fellow of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford. He's the author of an earlier book that deals with some of the same issues. That book is Private Lives and Public Surveillance, winner of the C. Wright Mills Award. His work has also appeared in a number of other places, including the Washington Post, the Washington Monthly, and the New York Times Book Review. Professor Rule, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's great to be with you.
One of the things that you mentioned in the preface to your book is that as you talk about these issues with colleagues, that you sometimes get one of two reactions. Either you have people who say, oh, don't worry about it, it's no big deal, on the one hand. On the other, you have people who say, yes, this is a very big deal and you should be worried. Something that, though, both of these groups seem to share in common is this feeling that this, what we're talking about here, has such momentum, it's gone so far, that whether you're worried about it or whether you're not, it seems unlikely that this is going to change. There's a certain sort of inevitable momentum behind this that seems to say, you might as well get used to it, that's just the way that things are going to be from now on.
Yes, well, we're talking about the appetite of big institutions, both government and private, to collect and share and use detailed personal data about people like ourselves. And a lot of people feel, just as you say, that these trends are proceeding on their own steam. There's no stopping them. Some people, even people who know better, say, well, the data's already lost. It's out of the box. And there's nothing that we can do except experience its repercussions. I don't believe that. I think that there are things that we could do, but it's certainly true that it's a major trend of our time to allow these data to be collected and to experience the consequences.
Mm-hmm. Something else that you mentioned maybe you can talk about for a moment is that this is not simply a technology problem in the sense that we now have the technology, so much information is digitized that it's easy to pass it around electronically. It's easy to amass great, vast databases of information and then to access that. So your argument is that this is not just a technology issue, a computer issue.
Well, that's true. We tend to, in a way, abdicate responsibility for these developments by saying, well, technology is doing this to us, as though technology were a thing that had its own ideas and its own aims. In fact, the tendency of big organizations, government and private institutions of various kinds, to collect and to use personal information to deal with people was well entrenched before anybody got the idea that the computer would help with these things. What computing has done in the last 40 years has been to make it vastly easier for organizations ranging from the IRS and the Homeland Security Department to credit reporting agencies and insurance companies to amass more information more easily and to slice it and dice it and to share it more widely than ever could have been done before.
Mm-hmm. So this is one must keep in mind that people both in the private and the public sector in the past, to the extent that they had the means to do it, did this very thing. It's just that now the means to do it are so much greater, more sophisticated, more powerful. You can amass more information than past technologies would allow you to do.
Indeed. I mean, the IRS, after all, was maintaining its files on taxpayers at the mid-20th century. In Europe, many welfare state institutions had data on people's work histories, for example, that formed the bases for pension schemes. In the United States, credit reporting goes way back to the early 20th century, and in the earliest days of my research in the 1960s, I can remember when credit records and credit reports were all still done by hand and by telephone. But, of course, the rise of computing has been a godsend to these activities because it's vastly cut the costs and vastly widened the prospects or the possibilities for collecting and creating and sharing data.
You, as you mentioned, and I mentioned, this was a subject that in your academic work you've been dealing with for decades now, and certainly before, it goes back, as you say, it goes back really before the explosion of computer databases and the internet and so forth. What was it that at that time said to you, this is an important subject, it may become increasingly important and is deserving of serious attention?
It's been a peculiar experience for me. I began to be fascinated by these things as a graduate student, and that's now getting on to be 40 years ago. Back in the late 60s, when I started paying attention to these activities, the idea that people would have identity cards or computerized records was relatively new. But one could see, even at that early time, that there were tensions, anxieties that people had about what was happening to their data, who was collecting it, who was using it, what difference it made in the way that they got treated. And in fact, in every over the years that I've been following the issue throughout my career as an academic social scientist, one sees every major democracy in the world, including the United States, has developed some kind of privacy codes in an attempt to protect people's interests in the information that's collected and used about them.
Our guest, just very quickly, in this part of Focus 580 is James Rule. He has been writing on the issues of privacy and surveillance for a long time. He's a distinguished affiliated scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at University of California, Berkeley, and his most recent book deals with this subject. The title is Privacy in Peril, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just give us a kind of a thumbnail sketch or a kind of a listing of what kinds of personal information about people is out there circulating in the world that they might not be aware of.
Well, many people are unaware that their website visits can be tracked through the placing of cookies on their computer so that the organizations that one interacts with on the web can know who else one has been, what other sites one has been visiting, and even what web pages one has been looking at and how long. It's not widely understood, for example, that credit information has a lot of uses besides credit, so that the data on your credit accounts, that is how much is outstanding and how promptly you've been paying, is reconverted for use in many places by insurance companies who use it to set the costs that are assessed to you when you apply for insurance. One of the things that strikes me over and over again as I look at these systems is the symbioses, that is the cooperative arrangements that involve sharing of data like credit data collected for one purpose for purposes quite distinct as in the use of credit data for insurance. And since 9/11, since the rise of all of our anxieties about terrorism, we know that government institutions connected with domestic security are delving into data systems compiled in the private sector to try to spot people they think may be dangerous.
I could imagine that some people saying that if you showed them, if you could somehow show them a map or give them a list of all of the personal information about them that is available and who's got it, that at least some of it, they might actually draw a distinction and say, some of this, I don't care if someone knows. For example, I mean, one might say, well, if someone wants to see what websites I've looked at, I don't care. It doesn't bother me. But then other kinds of information, their credit history, for example, their medical history, who knows? Maybe the fact that they might have gotten a speeding ticket or, you know, some variety of things, they might say, well, now that information, this I think that I would like to have better control of. How much do you think of the kind of information that we're talking about really does matter and would be things where people would say, yes, this I really think that should be kept private, or at least it should be only the person whoever has this information, I don't want them sharing that with anybody else.
Well, we often have that reaction about marketing uses of data.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that organizations from whom we buy things or websites from that we visit share the data about our interests and our buying habits upsets many people. There's an account in the book of a hotel that was known to cater to lesbian clientele who, in fact, had sold their guest list to companies that sold products that were apparently of interest to lesbian consumers. And I would imagine that the people who registered at that hotel would have preferred to keep that interest, if it was an interest, to themselves. I think we would do a lot better in protecting people's data and enabling people to protect their own data if the default condition were that one owned one's own data, at least for commercial purposes, and it could not be released without permission.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that it is the case that people are assuming that information, that perhaps they're providing that information to one entity, and they're assuming that entity is holding that information? That is, they're not aware the extent to which information like that is being shared, or in some cases, I think that you're absolutely correct that somebody might have some information about you, and that has value for them, and that there are other people who would be willing to pay money to have that information, so that not only are they just sharing that personal information, they're actually profiting from that.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the repercussions of the computer environment that we live in. That more and more databases are compiled electronically, and that easy access to electronically stored information means that information can be turned into a commodity, something that's bought and sold. A perfect example in this country is the increasing computerization of public record information on you find, for example, in courthouses, marriages, divorces, tax records, property records, records of things like building permits, all of which cumulatively, of course, tell a good deal about our lives. And that information, of course, is not of course, but as it turns out, is harvested, is collected, and is turned into reports that one can purchase, including reports on people's criminal records, marital histories, and things like that, most of which comes as a surprise to people when they realize that information generated in the first place as part of a public record has in fact then become a product.
Well, I would also expect that people would make the assumption that personal information about them, at least a good deal of the personal information about them, does indeed belong to them, that they own it. They're presuming that. What exactly does the law say?
Well, we don't have much in the way of rights of those kinds. What law, what privacy codes have done in the United States and other countries has largely been to open up personal information systems so that people may inform themselves more efficiently about what's happening to data on themselves. They certainly don't provide, in most cases, absolute control over the fate of data on oneself, and there are arguments why that might not be a good idea. So in the case of credit reporting in the United States, which is one of the most sophisticated ways of creating and using personal information, the credit privacy legislation that we have, the Fair Credit Reporting Act and its successors, make it possible to find out what's in one's credit record and even to challenge what one as a consumer might feel is inaccurate data on file. But they don't give us the right to strike items from our records. And in fact, the correction of credit records is largely at the discretion of credit reporting companies. Mm. Other countries do better. The United States has one of the least forceful privacy codes of any Western democracy. In the European Union, companies with which we do business may not, without our explicit permission, sell or trade data from our account. So that if you give to a charity or if you subscribe to a publication in France, for example, the data about one's gift or subscription has to remain with the organization to whom it was given, unless one, as the subscriber, gives one's okay. In the U.S., of course, the opposite assumption prevails, and I found myself personally declining to give to charity or making sure that my charitable donation was done anonymously simply to avoid the onslaught of further publicity from that same charity or from other ones.
Hmm. You know, just going back, I'm curious, you talked about the fact that now, and I think this has been the case now for I'm not sure how many years, that as a result of legislation on the national level, that the credit reporting agencies are obligated to once for everybody upon request, once I think it's once every year, to give them for free their credit report so that they can see what's there. Now, again, you said it's obviously it's if you see that there's something there that you believe is mistaken, it can be difficult to get that changed. But at least you can see it. And that, I think, consumer rights advocates said, well, this is good. This is a very important step that now people can actually see their credit reports and at least have some a little bit more control over what their credit history looks like. And, of mm-hmm. course, that's very important because if you want to get a credit card, you want to borrow money, they're going to take a look at that. So I guess the thing that I'm curious about is that since it's been possible for people to do that for free, how many people actually do that? You know, whether when you give people opportunity to open up a window on their personal information, and at least be involved and see what's there, how many people actually take advantage of that?
I don't have a number for that, but I know it's widespread, and I think that the reason why it's widespread is that we depend so much on credit, and credit grantors are required to notify people as to the reasons why credit is declined. So that notification sends people right back to the credit reporting agency to say, what's gone wrong, what's in my record, and I think on the whole that's a good thing. There are other kinds of record encounters that we all have that we don't know that we have, so that if you don't get on an airplane because you're on a watch list of some kind, or if you're blocked from sending money abroad, as one can be in this country because one's name appears on a government-maintained watch list, there's no comparable process for knowing what's gone wrong, what's in the record, and how to challenge it. And there have been ludicrous cases of 4-year-old passengers being blocked from getting on an airplane because they were their names appeared on a watch list. So record systems of all kinds vary enormously in terms of their openness, their one's ability to challenge them. People do challenge these systems when they know their workings, but not all of them are open to the degree that credit reporting is.
I think that that when we talk about these issues, there has been particular concern since 9/11 about the sacrifice of the sacrifice of control of this kind of personal information, of privacy, to security. And the concern has been government surveillance. I wonder whether when you look at the extent to which government collects and holds information about us and entities in the private sector do, how in fact those, broadly speaking, those two things compare.
It's striking to me how similar big systems of surveillance, as I call them, big systems of systematic accounting of people's lives resemble one another, whether they're government or private institutions. There's something about the logic of keeping track of millions of people at once and using the information in one system to make critical decisions about the people concerned, whether those decisions are whether to extend the credit limits on a credit card or whether to allow somebody on an air flight, they just seem to compel organizations to act in similar ways. So here we have systems of the most diverse sorts, systems for keeping track of taxpayers and taxes, systems for tracking people's criminal records, systems for recording what insurance claims that people have made. And they all get to look like each other as time goes on. There have been attempts, more in other countries than in this one, to create a single code of rights for to protect people's data. And those codes are probably stronger in Europe than they are in any other part of the world. But we don't do as well in the United States.
We have a caller to talk with in Madison. Let's go there. This is on our toll-free line. It's line number 4. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding using telephones, landline telephones that are cordless,
mm-hmm.
or cell phones or fax machines. Do they are they inherently safe, or am I just fooling myself by giving sensitive information over the phone? And I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Well, one thing that we know from the events of the last 2 years is that the current administration in Washington has been encouraging or requiring telephone service providers to yield the records of their of the connections that ordinary Americans are making, and one suspects the content of those calls as well. The legal status of information of telephone conversations apparently differs according to whether one is on a fixed line or a portable phone or a cell phone. When one is speaking on a portable phone, one is basically broadcasting, and the legal restrictions on the capture of that information are much less than for a fixed line phone. One big new demand on privacy that's emerged in the last 20 years has been through all of the information that's generated by cell phone use. Theoretically, a search warrant is necessary to capture the detail of conversations that people have on fixed line phones. Cellular phones leave records, of course, of where we've been and who we've been talking to.
We are at our midpoint here. Let me again introduce our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in. We're talking with James Rule. He is a distinguished affiliated scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at the University of California, Berkeley and has for many years been writing on this very subject about privacy and surveillance. He is the author of a recently published book, and the title is Privacy in Peril. The subtitle is How We're Sacrificing a Fundamental Right in Exchange for Security and Convenience, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions from listeners are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that probably people are somewhat aware, at least, about the possibility that someone could be listening into a phone conversation, and that they certainly should be aware that whatever they do on the Internet, they should almost just automatically assume that someone somewhere is looking at what they're doing and where they're going. I think at the same time, though, they're at least until recently, they're, I imagine people presume that in public places, there's a certain degree of anonymity in the crowd, but that's something I think that increasingly now is going away as there is more and more real-time surveillance going on of public places. How extensive is that, and is that something that we should also expect over time to see more and more of?
In Britain, which is the leader, if you want to think of it that way, in public video surveillance, I'm told that there are more than a million video cameras in place in public places monitoring people's movements. These are not just in rail stations and airports, but also in pubs and public streets. The most astounding developments in these video surveillance technologies has been the ability to program video cameras to pick out particular faces. Face recognition apparently is now not something that's strictly done only done by human beings. It can also be done by machine. In Britain, there have been efforts, successful efforts, to identify unregistered cars by their license plates through automatic video technology. So it's not inconceivable that we will eventually live in a world where we can all be recognized, either facially or by our license plates, as we go about from doing our daily chores and daily errands. And that, I think, is something that ought to give concern.
Let's talk with another listener. This is someone in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Yeah, actually, to kind of just a brief comment. And the last thing is 1984 is here, you know, in terms of the movie. An issue that you didn't talk about, and identity theft, and actually, I wonder how many times or at various places that our information is being compromised. As an alum of another university, and you know, I was notified that it was compromised, you know, a whole section or whatever it is. And, you know, they didn't know it for a couple of years. So I'm wondering other places that it is, that it's out there. And I think back at a time when, you know, students used to have their ID number. It was a Social Security. And so I think that, you know, in terms of our Social Security numbers, you know, I don't understand why this was never taken care of, you know. And as soon as you get into identity theft, and then it's your job to prove that it's not you. I'd like to have a comment on that.
Well, we've set up, we've seen created in this country an industry that produces credit so easily that it operates on a kind of hair trigger. And that, of course, makes it that much easier to get credit for fraudulent purposes. And identity theft, then, is, of course, an industry. Other countries, it's fascinating to note to me, other countries produce consumer credit, they have consumer credit institutions, credit cards, personal loans, without anything like the accumulation of personal data in credit files that we have. Since one has to, or one is invited to use one's Social Security number for so many purposes, that makes it that much easier to to obtain information that then can be used to impersonate someone else. And identity theft is one of the prices that we pay.
Yeah, the other one is that people don't realize, because I've done some database type things, and that actually it's grouping of people, and, you know, so it's not, you're not getting down to the individual initially. It's just that you do multiple correlations of these things and different factors, and it might not even totally relate to it, but you're actually grouping people, which seems to be something wrong with that too. So you can comment on that or whatever. And
all right. Well, thanks for the call.
Well, you're absolutely right. In credit and in advertising and in all kinds of other purposes, the important thing is to predict who's going to cause trouble. And if you're unfortunate enough to share characteristics with troublesome people, with people who don't pay their credit obligations, or with the suspected terrorists, one is apt to find oneself treated in the same way as those troublesome people. In the book, I speculate if it became known that all terrorists used a particular kind of toothpaste, it would not be a safe thing to select that kind of toothpaste in the supermarket, because, of course, our supermarket choices are recorded at the counter, and those databases on our consumer choices are, like all other databases, subject to subpoena and scrutiny. In credit, one can find one's credit blocked simply for making too many credit applications in a short period of time. The credit-granting organizations, credit card companies and other credit grantors, fear people who seem to be looking for a lot of credit in a hurry. And there can be excellent reasons why one might want to do that if one is doing a lot of shopping for the holidays, something like that. But the aim of these systems that are discussed in Privacy and Peril is to be efficient, not necessarily to be just. And, of course, there are some compelling reasons in matters of homeland security why one must be especially vigilant over the cases of people who seem to have to share in common characteristics with those who are believed or known to be dangerous. It's that kind of world that we live in which our records are compared to the records of a lot of other people, with particular eye to identifying people who are dangerous, who are troublesome, who are costly to the system. And one does not want to be bracketed in that same slot with those who have caused trouble in the past.
Hmm. Let's talk again. Another caller here. This is someone in Urbana. That's line 2. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? That's a very, very interesting subject. I'm concerned about the passive collection of information and, you know, where people volunteer. A friend of mine, sister wanted his DNA for some family research thing, so he sent it to this company, you know, took a swab, put it in a tube and sent it to this company, and who knows what they do with it. I mean, sent him a report, you know, about a month later. But also, I was concerned, I know RFID tags, radio frequency identification tags for products are being developed now. They're in large scale, for like group packaging, but pretty soon they'll be individual. And there's an argument in the industry now, and in, I don't know so much in government, about the fact that when you buy something now with a UPC code, you know, it just basically records the information because it's passive. Well, an RFID tag, the information is active in that the scanner turns on the data point, and the data point feeds back, like, you know, sweater, you know, wool, whatever. But the fact is, if they don't turn these off, they could read these things from, like, according to the literature I know, 15, 20 meters away, so you could walk into a store, and they could read everything on your underwear, your socks, your shoes, whatever. And I'm wondering if you know where that is in the law right now. Do you know anything about that?
I don't think there's any legal restriction on the practices that you describe. They've been enormously controversial lately as they've been applied to passport technology because passports, this country's passports and others as well, are increasingly being fitted with RFID chips so that the passport can be noted even without the person who holds it showing that passport. And many people privacy watchers, as I call them, of people like me, have worried that Americans abroad might be spotted without their knowing it by unfriendly parties as Americans simply by holding an American passport.
Yeah. I was going to say, you were talking earlier about cell phones. Last year in Rome, MIT did a thing. They developed an algorithm where they, at a Madonna concert, they basically inverted the signal from the cell phone company where, you know, the signal, the cell phone communicates with the towers, you know, they, like it's a two-way signal. They basically captured all these signals and followed all these cell phones to this concert, and they can, they, because of the cell tower has to be, you know, the, know where the phone is within like 30, a meter, I think, they basically followed like 20,000 cell phone numbers with little, you know, like points on this screen. And you can actually go to the website. They used to have it up on a website about 6 months ago, and you could actually watch this. You could watch these cell phones, you know, go to this concert, and you could see all these little lines pointing up. They, of course, they deleted the numbers, but it's amazing what you can do with electronics and following people. So I just wanted to say, if anybody knew about that, I just didn't know if you knew about that or not. But thank you.
All right,
I really appreciate your
call.
Work. Yeah, bye.
Well, see, there's one of those cases where there seems to be just to take a small example, there seems to be an upside and a downside that you might say, well, to be able to use a cell phone, for example, now that so many people have them and they carry them as a kind of a device that we can tell where people are at any point, that's an invasion of their privacy. On the other hand, someone would say, from a public safety sort of point of view, they would say, well, maybe that might not be such a bad thing. You know, what happens? You're hurt, you're in an accident, you're incapacitated, or you're capable of dialing 911, but you can't tell the emergency people where you are. Well, the device will tell them, and then they will be able to go there and help you. It seems that is it the case that there are cases where it's not, you wouldn't say clearly it's either one thing or another, it's either bad or good, that it's sort of a mix, and that means that it's just going to be much more difficult to control which kinds of information, of use of the information, we're going to be able to say, yes, I'd like you to be able to do this, but I don't want you to be able to do that.
Oh, that's exactly the position we're in with countless different kinds of different uses of our data. This problem would not be so intractable or so fascinating if it weren't for the fact that we have ambivalent attitudes about all of these, most of these data uses. There was a fascinating case a couple of years ago here in Northern California, where I live, of a school that fitted each of its pupils, an elementary school, fitted each of its pupils with an RFID badge that the pupil was to wear all day when he and she was on school premises. And the idea, of course, at least the publicly stated justification, was that this is a better way of keeping track of pupils. So if a pupil wanders off or if they're missing from class, it's instantly noted electronically. It provoked a very bad reaction here in the California community, and one of the parents who arose in the school board meeting to protest said, quote, our children are not merchandise. That is, they're not like sweaters or toothpaste tubes that might be fitted with an RFID tag. And in fact, in the course of the controversy, the school board stood down and the project was abandoned. But of course, one can imagine circumstances under which children or adults would be saved from dangerous situations by a system that would monitor them at all times. Mm-hmm. And for that matter, crime would be much easier to control if the police had a mechanism for knowing where everybody is at all times. Many crimes would, of course, disappear because the people who committed them would be immediately obvious to the police. But we don't want to live in a world like that, and we want the benefits, certainly, of being able to track down people who are in danger and to intervene, but we don't want our lives to be a total open book, and that's a conundrum. That's a dilemma that comes up over and over again when you start to look at systems of surveillance.
Mm-hmm. Well, this, I think what's really interesting and puzzling and makes this more difficult is that, and on the one hand, you have people suggesting future scenarios where a totalitarian government, for example, would require all of its citizens to be chipped, the way that we chip our pets now, so that if they get lost, we'll be able to find them. And the assumption would be that this is something that would be forced on people. On the other hand, you could imagine a set of circumstances arising where if you sell it to people well enough, they would do this willingly. And so that seems to be the central idea here, that we have to, you know, we do have to consider that, yes, there might some aspects of making our information available might be desirable, and indeed it might make our lives a little easier in some sense. But you have to consider all the possible ramifications of doing that.
Well, imagine a world in which people have the option, not the requirement, of having computer chips implanted under their skin so that their presence could be noted and linked to a database. And imagine that the Homeland Security people offered the option of people who'd had such implants done passing quickly without taking off their shoes or their belts through security at airports and going happily on their way to visit their relatives for Thanksgiving or whatever they're doing. I'm sure many people would be tempted to have themselves implanted with chips simply to avoid the anxieties and hassles that we all experience of being checked in more obtrusive ways. I myself would hate to live in a world where we were all monitored in that fashion, even if it were done for benign purposes. There's something unappealing about it. And of course, as you say, if that information were used in oppressive ways, which is certainly not a far-fetched possibility, our lives would be miserable. There's talk now, not just talk, there are technologies which basically generate images of people undressed so as to show whether they're carrying concealed weapons or materials for bombs or something like that, that can be applied to travelers as they join air flights. So you see an image of the traveler in great detail, enough to show, for example, the size of a woman's nipples without her having to undress. Whether that makes anybody feel better, the fact that you're not physically undressed when you're seen undressed is an open question. But if that were the price of getting on an air flight or missing one's flight, if that made the difference, I think a lot of us would probably opt for what they call the naked machines.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is James Rule. He's Distinguished Affiliated Scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at the University of California at Berkeley, and has for decades now been writing on these very issues, surveillance and privacy. He's the author of the book Private Lives and Public Surveillance, a winner of the C. Wright Mills Award. His work has appeared in various other places, Washington Post, Washington Monthly, New York Times Book Review. His new book deals with these issues, what we're talking about here this morning, and the title of that book is Privacy in Peril, How We're Sacrificing a Fundamental Right in Exchange for Security and Convenience. It's published by the Oxford University Press. We do have another caller here and about 10 minutes left. The number 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hi. I know the show tends to be very even-handed about things, but frankly, I'm pretty appalled that you can speak even-handedly about civil liberties and invasion of our privacy to supervise our every move. Was it Benjamin Franklin who said people who worry about security over civil liberties end up with neither? Well, that's the way I feel about being tracked. If they want to track somebody who they think is a felon and is supposed to be in work situations, fine, but don't track me, and I don't want anybody else tracked as well. So I would be a little less even-handed in my approach. I think it is, when in doubt, vote for civil liberties and democracy, and don't worry about security, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, I'm not sure that you would disagree with a statement like that.
No, but in fact, one of the purposes of the book is to document the enormous pressures that move us all in the opposite direction. We all have this feeling, which I think is correct as far as it goes, that we don't want people snooping into our own business. But at the same time, we want things that provide pretext for collecting a lot of information. And, credit is a perfect example. Most Americans rely very heavily on credit. And as credit consumers, we're hard put, I think. We don't really have our speech prepared when we want to say, look, we shouldn't really have to give up that much information. Now, in fact, there are countries, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, which provide credit quite readily, Australia and France, without the legal right to accumulate the kind of credit information for industry purposes that are accumulated in the U.S. But we don't really think about the alternatives to systems that run on these intensive uses of personal data that we're accustomed to in America.
We're coming down to the point here. We have maybe about 5 minutes left. And one thing I do want to just get back to a little bit is to talk about the way that personal information about us circulates in the commercial world. And as you mentioned, the fact that in Europe, for example, there are much greater restrictions on that. And here in the book, you write that here in the United States, we have about the most open It's about the most open on those grounds as any place, anywhere in the world. Is it likely that something's going to happen, or would you say that that's something that people should indeed press for and government ought to address to give people more control over how maybe it's their information on their buying habits, where they spend their money, what they do with their time? I suppose that also would include information about their healthcare, all that sort of stuff, that they're really, we ought to be able to have more control over not just who has that information, but then how between the people who have it, how that is shared.
There are many things that we could do. There are many things that, many possibilities for privacy laws that would be far more privacy friendly than we have in the United States now. I think it would be a terrific thing, for example, if people had a kind of commercial property right over personal information about themselves, so that the right to buy and sell and trade for profit personal data, as is the case so widely when credit and insurance and marketing in this country, were subject to people's ownership of data about themselves, so that one could not sell credit reports or collect personal information for credit purposes without the assent of the person concerned. And we would all then basically be owners of data about ourselves, much as one might own the mineral rights to a piece of property, or much in the sense that celebrities own the right to exploitation of their of data about themselves. That would be a terrific shot in the arm for privacy consciousness, because everybody would then realize that they are the source of something with value, and that they could simply by not doing anything block the trade in such data. We're a long way from that in the U.S. Other countries mostly do much, other prosperous democracies, particularly the European Union, mostly do much better than we do.
Well, just as a way of summing up here in the couple of minutes that we have left, going back to the beginning, we talked about the fact that sometimes people react to this in a couple of ways. Either they say don't lose sleep over it, or they say this is very serious and you should worry. But the thing that often both these camps share is this idea that there's no going back. Now, you've said you should not make that conclusion, that somehow all is lost as far as privacy is concerned and you might as well give it up. So having said that, then the question is, well, what do you think we should be doing in regards to this?
I think we should be looking for ways of getting the work of the country done with the accumulation of less rather than more personal data. I think people should demand that institutions, both in the government and the private sector, find ways of transacting their business so that the reams of personal information that are now collected are either not collected in the first place or eliminated as quickly as possible. That's a very, very difficult suggestion to sell to government and private institutions, but there's no reason why it couldn't be pursued. People talk about the protection of privacy as though it were somehow technologically very difficult, or as though the battle for the protection of personal information were already lost. In fact, there are many, many things that we could do to reduce the accumulation of personal data or the collection of personal data in the first place. The problem is not technological. The problem is that these steps are excruciating. They're painful. They make life somewhat less convenient. They expose us to more risks, either risks of terrorist attack or risks of our fellow consumers misusing credit. And we tend to acquiesce to a world in which personal data are collected in order to make life more convenient. And the net result is a world in which privacy is a smaller and smaller island in a world of surveillance.
Well, there we must stop. Again, for people who would like to read more on this issue, you should look for the book Privacy in Peril by our guest James B. Rule. He is Distinguished Affiliated Scholar at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at the University of California at Berkeley. And Dr. Rule, thanks very much.
It's been great being with you.